This is 1988 Tops, where every card has a story to tell. Your hosts are David McKellis and Matt Kuzma. Let's play ball. Welcome back to 1988 Tops. David, what's our card for this week?
Our card this week is card number 533, John Farrell, pitcher for Cleveland.
All right, John Farrell. Before we get to that, we do have follow-up from previous episodes, including a correction from last week's episode on Kent Herbeck.
At some point in the episode, I heard myself call Kent Herbeck Ron, and I said something like, and Ron thought blank. And I was like, who is Ron? I have no idea why I called him Ron. To be fair, a lot of our dudes in this set are named Ron.
We've had a lot of Rons.
A lot of Rons, a lot of Dons. I think 9 Mikes. So many Mikes. It's like a full 10th of the episodes are Mikes.
More guys named Len than I would have expected to.
But not enough. Still not enough. So apologies to Kent Ron Herbeck. I don't even know what I was thinking of. It doesn't even make any sense. Like, what? I don't think we referenced anyone named Ron in the episode.
So, mea culpa, listeners, if we accidentally called Kent Herbeck Ron, like, easily a dozen players in the set are named Ron. So, folks, if you find other verbal slip-ups, please feel free to send them into the mailbag at 1988topspodcast@gmail.com. We had some other follow-up. We talked briefly about Kent's connection with a wrestler, but there was another wrestling connection that we needed to discuss, David.
I'm not sure how we skipped this. I did have it in our notes last week. Maybe ride that skip button if you are an Atlanta Braves fan. We're going to talk about the Ron Gant incident again. Well, we're going to let Randy Macho Man Poffo talk about it. Friend of Tito Landrum. Great baseball player, one of the greatest baseball players in his own mind.
Top prospect from the St. Louis Cardinals organization, could have been a major leaguer, instead turned out to be one of the greatest stars in wrestling, and he has some expert opinion on the T-Rex tackle.
We went right to an expert for some analysis of that play. Here's what our expert had to say.
Based on what I saw, Kent Herbeck mastered the technique. Step over to him. Yeah. Herbeck, I'm impressed. Through the Macho Man's eyes, the tag was clean. And Gant was out. So what's all this about that? Yeah.
We've got the verdict in there that it was totally fair. Plus, I know that the umpires were watching, but I don't think the ref was looking. So there's no foul there at all. Totally fair call. No chair was used in view of the umpire either. So I think he's all good. And Kent Herbeck, 2-time World Series ring holder.
Maybe he also could have been the King of the Ring. Mm. Could have won the Royal Rumble. He could have body slammed Yokozuna. All of these things were possibilities. But instead, Kent decided to have a hunting and fishing show.
Glad to have that confirmation from the Macho Man. Now let's go to this week's episode and John Farrell. And why are we talking about John today?
John Farrell was recently referenced in the Jim Traber episode. So when we talked about Trabes, talked about some other teammates of his at Oklahoma State University who are in the 1988 top set. And I didn't recognize this name. I guess I was not paying attention to the Red Sox in the 2010s enough, or I didn't connect the two that the manager of the Boston Red Sox was also a player in 1988. He has a Sabre bio, and we haven't covered that many players from this Cleveland team. His Sabre bio is written by Bill Nowlin. So thank you to Bill Nowlin once again for your work on the Sabre bio project. John Farrell had a couple of good years, and then injuries took him out of baseball for 2 full seasons. And since then, he's had a very long coaching and management career and won a couple rings with the Red Sox. And he also had a very interesting trade, unlike any that we have discussed to this point.
Let's go to the front of 533. And we have John Farrell in kind of relaxed picture day pose. It looks like maybe John's having this photo taken in an office park. It's just a very nondescript background. It doesn't look at all baseball related. I mean, there is a net maybe from a driving range in the background and a light on a post. It's just a very mysterious background. He's not really smiling. And as I zoomed in extra, it's kind of a suspect dental issue going on.
He looks in pain. It does look a little bit like a carnival atmosphere. There's a net behind in case somebody falls out of the zipper. I believe this was taken at Cleveland Municipal Stadium, the mistake by the lake. Unlike a lot of these guys whose pictures were taken clearly at spring training, these guys are all, I think we saw this on like the Corey Snyder team leaders card for Cleveland and maybe the Ron Kittle card. Like, this stadium is way too big for preseason. I'm pretty sure that this is their normal stadium, but it's also very nondescript. Unlike the pictures that are taken at Old Comiskey Park that have the bright yellow rails so you can easily tell what it is and where it is, this is just kind of like nondescript giant baseball field.
And it's taken at dusk, so you can't see anything behind it. You can't tell. Like, it really could be a covered parking lot on the right-hand side of the card with, you know, a kind of a circus tent in the background and that light post above it, like at the state fair. It could be like a state fairground. It makes John look a little ominous here that they've discovered him and the Scooby-Doo gang is in the background looking for him. Like, why couldn't they do it during the day, like when it's light outside? Right. Why do they have to do it at night with no lights on? It looks creepy. It's just a kind of a creepy look for John. Maybe the rest of the team is at spring training and John was kind of left behind and they're like, you're stuck here. We might as well just take your picture. And he's like, yeah, but it's like March. It's cold. It's dark here. They're like, well, it's...
They just forgot about him. It's a Home Alone situation. Sorry, John.
Let's go to the back of 533. We have John Farrell, 6'4", 210, right-handed thrower and batter. Drafted by the Indians in the second round of 1984. Born August 4th, 1962 in Monmouth Park, New Jersey, with a home in Monmouth Beach, New Jersey.
Turns out Monmouth Park, New Jersey isn't a thing. There's no town called Monmouth Park that I could find. Listeners, correct me if I'm wrong. There is a racetrack with that name, so maybe he grew up at the racetrack.
He was at the racetrack. I mean, that's a pretty typical New Jersey story, right?
Yep, I think that's on Greetings from Asbury Park. Bruce Springsteen says a lot of people's names, sings about them living at a racetrack. John was born in Monmouth Beach, a small beach community on the Jersey Shore. About 1,300 people there in 1960, now over 3,000, still pretty small. There is a ferry that takes about 40 minutes to get to Manhattan from that area, so there's a lot of people commuting into New York, and John grew up as a fan of New York baseball teams. John's father, Tom, was a left-handed pitcher who had been in Cleveland's system in the 1950s. He played 3 seasons in the minors before calling it a career, never really making it close to the majors. Tom and his wife, Suzanne, had 6 kids, 4 girls and 2 boys. John's father was a commercial fisherman, but always a baseball fan, and he taught his kids about baseball. John developed into a talented pitcher, a righty, unlike his dad. Maybe his career would have been even extended further if he had been a lefty. But John liked baseball, but assumed he would end up going into fishing, just like his dad did. He knew he was good, and in high school, it became clear that maybe he could even go farther.
And we have a fun fact on the back of the card that John was a 1980 graduate of Shore Regional High School, West Long Branch, New Jersey. He and wife have a son, Jeremy.
We'll get to his wife and kids later in the episode, but John played baseball and basketball at Shore Regional. Notable alumni, Holly Black, co-author of the Spiderwick Chronicles. And if you see a faded sign at the side of the New Jersey Turnpike, it says 15 miles to Fred Schneider's house. He also went to Shore Regional High School. Fred Schneider, of course, of the B-52s. Coming out of Shore, the Oakland A's selected John in the 9th round. There was no signing bonus offered, and John said he was offered a monthly salary and a plane ticket. So he declined, decided to go to college, attending Oklahoma State in Stillwater. In 1981, he's teammates with Robbie Wine, Mickey Tettleton, and Jim Traber. The Cowboys went 52-17, finishing runner-up in the College World Series.
After his sophomore season, he played in the Cape Cod League in Hyannis, and he described the experience as memorable. He slept on a rollaway cot in a backyard tool shed apartment with skunks as neighbors. It sounds great. In John's four seasons at Oklahoma State, the Cowboys won the Big Eight Conference every year and made the College World Series every year. And after John's junior season, he was selected in the 16th round by Cleveland. He had been injured as a junior, so he thought maybe he would go back for his senior year and get a better draft position the following year. And it worked. His senior year, he played on a Cowboys team with Pete Incaviglia. John went 12-2 with a 3.16 ERA, and he had a really good offense supporting him as well. They hit 313 as a team. But John, to be honest, didn't really need much of the help. He set an OSU record by throwing five shutouts, including a no-hitter versus Missouri Southern University. And that great senior season convinced Cleveland to pick him again. And we have a This Way to the Clubhouse that John signed as a second-round draft selection with the Cleveland Indians June 12, 1984, by scout Red Gaskell.
Red Gaskell, the scout who signed John, had served in World War II. He survived his ship getting torpedoed in the Philippines and then spent 35 years as a scout for the Mets, Expos, and Cleveland after a brief minor league baseball career. He was credited with giving the Mets a heads up about a young pitcher from Texas, and the Mets would pick Nolan Ryan, partially based off of Red's recommendation. Nolan Ryan would credit Red with getting him started when Red Gaskell passed away. Gaskell was inducted into the Texas Baseball Scout Hall of Fame in 1999, and he passed away in 2010 at the age of 89. He was able to sign John, and Farrell goes to Class A Waterloo, where his record at Class A and stats were unimpressive. He was 0-5 with a 6.44 ERA at A level. He had a whip over 2, and yet he was promoted to AAA. In five games with the Maine Guides, he was much better. He was 2-1 with a 3.76 ERA. That was the only winning record that he had in the minor leagues. He cut his hits per nine innings in half, and he was pitching pretty well. But this run just shows a bunch of lines on a card that don't scream big league pitcher. The next two seasons he spends at Double A, and at Waterbury the first year his ERA is over 5, giving up more than a hit per inning, 7-13 record in 25 games. 1986 he improves, dropping his ERA to 3.06 thanks to improved command and keeping runners off base.
He was promoted back to Triple A in 1987. The AAA team was now at Buffalo, and his numbers look really rough. In 26 games, 156 innings pitched, and he's got a 6-12 record with a 5.83 ERA, gave up 26 home runs, which is 1.5 home runs every nine innings, double his previous high. Doesn't look like a great pitching prospect, but Cleveland was terrible. Despite being picked by Sports Illustrated in the 1987 season preview edition for them to win the AL East, they lost 100 games. So they want to bring up some prospects and give them some playing time. This team had some good offensive players, but their pitching staff had been decimated. You know, their best pitchers were 48-year-old Phil Niekro and 42-year-old Steve Carlton. They had eight pitchers with more than 10 starts, none of them with an ERA plus over 100. And so we really wanted to try out some new guys and bring them up.
John said, "I got the call basically by attrition. Everyone else went down before me. I might have been the 21st pitcher that year. I was 6-12. I'd been pitching well probably the four starts prior with varying success throughout the year, mostly lack of success." But he got called up in August regardless. He said, "I felt like I was prepared mentally as much as physically. Even though his stats didn't show it, he felt like he was ready." Cleveland, they didn't expect too much. They're 45-73 in dead last place. John had always been a starter in the minors, had never pitched in relief. He came in the top of the 12th inning in his first game against Milwaukee with the score tied 8-8. He threw two pitches and gave up hits to Paul Molitor and then Robin Yount. Not a great way to start, but then he got Glenn Braggs to hit into a double play. After a walk, he was able to get out of the inning, and in the bottom of the 12th inning, Mr. Clutch, all-star Pat Tabler, who stole Kent Herbeck's all-star spot, got a two-out single to give John Farrell a win. Also, I want to keep calling him Will Farrell, and so if I make that mistake, know that I've already called it.
We're leaving it in. We're leaving it in if it happens. And John said about this game, about this first win, he said, I'm in Cleveland all of 6 hours. I throw 13 or 14 pitches and I get a victory. Imagine that. I mean, he also gave up two hits and a walk, but got out of the inning somehow. That was John's only relief appearance of the year. His next start was a complete game against the Tigers. He gave up two earned runs and got a win. Followed that up with a 9-inning, 3-hit performance against Milwaukee, where he gave up no runs, but did not get a complete game shutout because he got 0 runs of support. He left the game tied 0-0, and Doug Jones blew the game in the 10th. John did hold Paul Molitor hitless in that game, which broke his 39-game hitting streak. He was again great in a win against Detroit for win number 3, and then he shut down Boston at Fenway on September 5th. So through 5 games, he's 4-0 with a 1.59 ERA in 34 innings. He had 5 more starts that season where he was 1-1 and his ERA was above 5. But overall, for 10 games, he had a 5-1 record and a 3.39 ERA. So a very good debut in the major leagues, setting him up for 1988.
And Cleveland thought that way as well. He opened 1988 on the big league team, and he had a good, if sometimes uneven, season. The team was closer to 500 this year, and John went 14-10. So to see that kind of winning record on a second-year pitcher, his ERA was 4.24, so right around league average. He kept home runs down, giving up only 15 in 210 innings, but he had a good year, and Cleveland expected him to be around a while. Followed that up with another good 1989, and he made some mechanical changes, struck out a career-high 132 in 208 innings. His ERA dropped to 3.63. He is allowing fewer base runners, but his record is 9-14 thanks to some tough luck. In 11 of his starts, he got 2 or fewer runs of support, and that accounted for 10 of those losses. Cleveland finished 6th out of the 7 teams in the AL East. They had a good rotation with Bud Black, Greg Swindell, Tom Candiotti all pitching well. All of those guys were 4-WAR players, and Farrell was a 3-WAR player, so he was a really solid starting pitcher, but the offense scored the fewest runs in the American League, despite having 4 solid starters. John took a no-hitter into the 9th inning against the Royals. After an error, he gave up a hit to Kevin Seitzer. He ended up getting pulled and had to settle for a 3-1 victory.
In 1990, Farrell's elbow gave him some problems in the spring. He had had some tightness previously, but in 1990, the problem worsened. But he starts the season anyway, and in 17 starts, he was okay. But then in late June, after a 5-inning, 1-run performance, the pain was just too much, and he was shut down for 3 months. He came back for a couple starts in September, but the pain recurred, and in October, he had surgery, having a bone chip removed and a torn ligament repaired, and his ulnar nerve relocated. When asked how he was pitching with all of these problems, John said, "A blue-collar background, hard work, that's something I grew up with, and I just expected myself to keep going. Besides, I did have periods where the elbow didn't bother me." So he had said that maybe it was a twinge or a light pop during his final start in 1987. In 1988 and 1989, he made 30 starts anyway and didn't have an MRI to address this pain or any of these issues until 1990. So he just toughed it out, rubbed some dirt on it, and pitched anyway for 2 years after having what he thought was a pop in his elbow.
He had a torn ligament and pitched 200 plus innings 2 years in a row. There's something more to that than just a blue-collar background, but definitely just the fact that they didn't give him an MRI, that he didn't want to miss out on playing time because he's got service time. He's got to get his career going. He doesn't want to be the guy who's saying he's got an elbow problem, and nobody wants to, at the end of your first season where you just pitched really well, get marked as a guy who needs Tommy John surgery. So after almost a year of rehab from that first operation, his arm just isn't feeling any better, and he ends up having to have a second operation in 1991. He had torn the ligament completely off the bone and it had to be reattached. So in November 1991, after 2 surgeries, Cleveland can't justify keeping him on the roster, so they release him. He ends up missing all of 1992 as well, Despite knowing that he was going to likely miss all of 1992, California signed him anyways. Angels Vice President for Baseball Operations Dan O'Brien said, "It might sound corny, but it's true. If you can bet on a man's character and ability, then you've got a good chance to succeed. He's a bulldog with enormous character." Knowing that he would pitch 500 innings after feeling a ligament pop, bulldog or something else sounds right as a description there of his work ethic. But now, could he recover and come back and be a successful big league pitcher again? That remains to be seen.
So he started 1993 with California and through mid-June was in the rotation. In 12 starts, he had an ERA over 7 and opponents hit .291 off of John. So he was sent down to AAA Vancouver to work things out, and he pitched well there, earning a recall back up to the majors. But overall for the year, he finished with a 3-12 record and a 7.35 ERA. It is pretty impressive that he pitched 90 innings, with the Angels giving him chances even though he wasn't playing particularly well. And John said that after sitting out 2.5 years, he had lost 4 or 5 miles per hour on his fastball, and he just wasn't the same pitcher anymore. But 1994, he's still trying. He pitched well at Vancouver, but with the Angels in 3 games in the majors, he had a 9 ERA, and he ended up being released. Signing back with Cleveland in 1994 and finishing the year with AAA Charlotte as the strike ended the season.
1995, he pitches well for AAA Buffalo, gets called up to Cleveland for 1 game. 1996, he goes to spring training with Seattle but ends up released prior to opening day. He re-signs with Cleveland, starts at Buffalo, but then was traded to Detroit for minor leaguer Greg Granger. At AAA Toledo, he had an 8.10 ERA, did get into 2 games for the Tigers, but gave up 10 runs in 6 innings, and he decided to call it a career.
So closing the book on John Farrell, 8 seasons in the major leagues with a record of 36 wins and 46 losses, 13 complete games with an ERA of 4.56. That's an ERA plus of 91. He loved to face Mr. Mariner Alvin Davis. 5-26, all singles is all that he gave up for Alvin Davis. Randy Bush went only 4-26 against him. And Kent Herbeck went only 4-23 against him, but one of those was a home run. He hated to face Dan Gladden, who went 12-25 against him. Lou Whitaker went 7-16 with 3 of those home runs. And then Officer Ron Karkovice, one of the best runs, 4-6 with 3 home runs, just lit him up. Also had 2 walks. That's an OPS of 2.917. And David, this is where I would ask, what about in retirement? But at the beginning of this episode, you'd said that he was involved in an interesting trade. So what's up with that?
We've got another 15 years before this trade takes place. So we'll get to it. We'll get to it. First, he went back to Oklahoma State. He's an assistant coach, recruiting coordinator. He also took the opportunity to finish up his degree. He needed a few more credit hours, so he went back, finished his degree. He's married to Susan, who he met at Oklahoma State, and they had 3 sons, one of whom was referenced earlier on the card, Jeremy, who was drafted by the Pirates in 2008 and made it as high as AAA as an infielder. Shane was drafted by Toronto in 2011, but never played in the minors. He rose through the front office ranks and is currently the Blue Jays' director of scouting. And his son Luke was drafted by Kansas City in 2013. He made it to the big leagues in 2017 for the Royals and pitched in parts of 6 seasons for Kansas City, Cincinnati, the Cubs, Rangers, and Twins. He is still an active pitcher and pitched in 2024 spring training for Washington. So after a few years as a pitching coach for OSU, John had been in contact with Cleveland and was brought in as a farm director in the early 2000s, serving in that role for 5 years when his former teammate Terry Francona called him up ahead of the 2007 season to be the Red Sox pitching coach. In that position, he devoted a lot of time to helping Daisuke Matsusaka, and John even learned some Japanese to help Daisuke. In the first year as pitching coach, he helped the Red Sox win the World Series over the Rockies. John stuck around in that role for a few seasons, and then after 2010, the Blue Jays hired him to manage the team. He had 2 fourth-place finishes, nothing too impressive, but as John was managing the Blue Jays, the Red Sox fired Terry Francona, brought in Bobby Valentine, fired Bobby Valentine after a last-place finish, And they knew that Farrell wanted to go back to Boston, and Toronto knew that he wanted to go back to Boston, so they arranged a trade. We have not had a manager trade, I don't think. I think we discussed it in an episode where we talked about Chuck Tanner. I don't remember which episode that is. Maybe Tommy John, who would have played for the 1970s White Sox. But Boston sends Mike Aviles to Toronto in exchange for manager John Farrell and pitcher David Carpenter. Carpenter ends up getting released. Aviles played a couple seasons, was a pretty good player. But in 2013, Farrell takes the last place Red Sox to first place, winning another title, this time as a manager. But then as quickly as they rose, the Red Sox fell back to last place in 2014 and 15. Farrell took them to the playoffs in 2016 and 17, but lost in the ALDS both years and was fired after 2017. Since then, he's been with the Reds as a scout and in their scouting department in their farm system.
So, David, we started this episode with a pitching prospect in a dark, lonely stadium. And now we've got a guy who's been a really accomplished manager and front office guy. So after looking at him a little bit more, what do we think?
John Farrell is in the Oklahoma State Baseball Hall of Fame with Jim Traber and Mickey Tettleton, his old teammates, and Pete Incaviglia. And he's in the Jersey Shore Sports Hall of Fame as well. And he is a guy who got to the majors despite his stats, despite it looking like, why are you calling up a guy with a 6 ERA? But Cleveland did not have another choice. And so John gets a chance due to injuries, and he ran with it. But he also tore a ligament that first season. After that very good first season, he then pitches 200-plus innings the next 2 years. Again, just determination, grit, some kind of stupidity. That's absurd that he was able to do that, and he was good. Like, all three of those seasons, he was a better-than-average pitcher and developed into one of Cleveland's best pitchers for a couple seasons. They thought that he was going to be a pitcher of the future, but when that injury caught up to him, he just couldn't do it anymore. He came back after 2+ years of recovery time. That's kind of the perfect person to be a pitching coach who can speak to the difficulties of recovering from injury. He's got to adapt and develop and learn new pitches because he doesn't have the speed anymore. John Farrell had been through it all, was able to also adapt and coach a great pitcher from another country with a language that they did not share. Daisuke Matsusaka had 2 great seasons with John as his pitching coach, and they won the World Series. So it's pretty amazing how this guy, who after 1 year could have been out of baseball with that ligament injury, went on to both persevere, have a moderately successful career, and then go on to something even greater and step into that leadership role and win multiple World Series on the field as a manager and a pitching coach.
We also have that bit from California signing him anyway, even though they knew that he was not going to play that whole year. And them just saying that his character and what he brought to the dugout and team and his future prospect of being involved with their organization was valuable enough to go ahead and sign him anyway really does speak to some other talent there that they were looking for.
That's something about that trade, too. I don't pay a lot of attention to managers and how much money they make. I feel like people get kind of up in arms about player salaries, but managers don't actually make that much money. And generally, if I'm remembering this correctly, they get paid something similar to a 1 WAR player. The Red Sox thought enough of John to trade an actual decent big league player rather than sign somebody who was a free manager. They decided to give up a player for him. That's kind of a big deal and something that we don't see a lot. I'm sure that we'll talk about it further. We may get notes about more recent times that that's happened, but that does show that people are willing to do things that are maybe out of the ordinary to have John Farrell involved on their team.
A great story, if maybe a spooky card. So thank you very much for that today, David. And thank you to you at home. If you have any nominees for other members of the Jersey Shore Hall of Fame, we'd love to hear them. Send them to our Instagram. We're at 1988 Tops Podcast. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.